get into the theater and the usher nods me in. They know me here. I descend down the staircase behind the movie screen that only select people know about. The door at the bottom opens and I walk in. The sound of movie spoilers fill the air. The barkeep has my drink ready and motions me to the back. The rest of the crew are here already. This is my type of place and these are my type of people. Join me as we discuss the inner secrets of cinema. Have a seat in the spoiler room.
And welcome, my friends, once again for joining us here in the spoiler room. And tonight, man, we are continuing our plastic surgery horror month here that I, for some reason, chose to. And made me question my decisions occasionally because some of these movies I forgot just how interesting they are. And tonight I've got a great panel with me to talk about The Skin I Live In from 2011. First off, he's back with us in the spoiler room. It is the lovely Andrew Shearer. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm lovely. Thank you.
And next to Andrew Shearer, she is back with us as well. Give it up for Kara. How are you doing tonight, Kara?
Doing pretty good.
Fantastic. And yes, tonight we are talking about The Skin I Live In. And Andrew, did you want to try to give the synopsis of this film?
Oh boy, I will do my best. How okay. about that?
Sounds good.
Skin I Live In is directed by Pedro Almodovar, and it is a horror movie about a brilliant but very disturbed surgeon, and he exacts brilliant and disturbing revenge when his daughter is raped.
It, that's a good way to put it. That's really a nice, I like that. That's... It is a spoiler room. We will get into it, but that's a good, I like that. That's a good on the surface summary before we dig under the skin. Oh, sorry. I couldn't help it. So we'll start with Kara. Kara, when you first saw this film, what were your initial feelings when the credits rolled?
I really didn't get the grasp of it until the second watch, just because. And I think it's pretty characteristic of most of Almodovar's films is where he presents you a story, but you realize not everything is as it seems. So it's, you kind of have to go back and catch what you missed. And then it's like, oh, well, this is what's really going on. I thought this was the story, but they're actually telling me something else. And it just, parts of it just flew right over my head.
Yeah, me too. And then when it gets revealed, which we will be talking about, You almost slap your head. You go, oh, okay. I didn't see that one coming. But at the same time, you see a few hints. But yeah, the story in this is really presented interestingly with it. And Andrew, how about you with when you first saw The Skin I Live In?
I remember being really excited about it. I remember seeing the trailer at the theater. You know, this was like his first like really big commercial release, if I'm not mistaken. And I remember it. Showing up in the trailers, like, what the hell is this? Because it just showed the woman in the mask running around in that, you know what I mean, with the knife, and we're going like, this does not look like, you know, one of his other movies. But we'd heard that it was a loose remake of Eyes Without a Face, the classic 1960 French horror movie. And so when we were watching it, all we were doing is like comparing that, you know what I mean, in our heads, I think. And so I'm kind of in the same boat as you guys, where there's so much more to it than that. And I don't feel like I gave it a fair chance back then. I rewatched it, and I am looking forward to having some things explained to me as we have this conversation.
And for me, well, I remember the controversy back when I was just a young lad between Tie Me Up and Tie Me Down.
Right.
And that was an indie film that everybody was throwing a fit about. And of course, it only showed at select theaters. So of course, never really saw it. I rented it years later. And in all honesty, I went, what was the big deal? although I do remember, if I remember with Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, that was the first time I think I've ever seen on screen the character go to the bathroom. Unabashedly just go to the bathroom. So, not like graphically, just matter of factly, but I remember that, but, and not much else of that, but that movie. So going into this one, I was just like, okay, you know, I had heard the stories, and then watching it, my brain, this film is dense. It goes through so much stuff, story and things going on, that it took a while for my brain to take everything in at the end. And at the end, I just sat there and went, you know what? I've seen some disturbing horror films in my day, and I honestly think this is one of the most, if not the most disturbing film I've actually watched. And that was back in 2011, before I'd seen a few other films. But even today, watching it again for the show, it is still one of the most disturbing films. And what's interesting about it is, if you look at it just on the surface, you're like, yeah. And I'm like, no, once you watch it through the first time, and then you watch it through the second time, knowing what the big reveal is, there's a whole nother level of fucked upery in this film, I think. Because you're watching it going, oh my God. You know, because the first time you're not sure, and your brain kind of has to backtrack, and you went, holy crap, all of that was this, you know. And then, but watching it the second time, you know right away who Vera is. And you're just like, okay, this just is even way more disturbing now that I know who she is. But we'll get to that at first. But the film starts out, you know, I think we're introduced to Antonio Banderas' character, who's a doctor, who a brilliant plastic surgeon who seems to be big about, you know, burns. He focuses on burns and plastic surgery and such. But we're introduced really to the female character first, Vera, and she's in a bodysuit. And I mean, there's so many questions just within the first 5 minutes. Andrew, would you agree? I mean, he opens this film. I mean, she's getting antidepressants. She's in a bodysuit. There's mute. I mean, how would you think about this film opening just with pretty much leaving all these questions just like right away? I mean, he doesn't pull any punches in the first 5 minutes, I don't think.
Well, again, it's a really kind of commercial way to open your movie with a lot of sizzle and action, you know?
Yeah.
But it also kind of ties into what we talked about Hitchcock's theory of suspense, which is letting the audience know, you know, more than the characters know, so that then he can get that nonlinear thing going and create that mystery and suspense. It's like, well, we've got these little pieces, and now we're sitting there the whole rest of the movie trying to put them together. And mm-hmm. So we do know more. I think it makes it scary. Like I was totally gripped by it.
Yeah. Well, because you're wondering what's going on. Why has he got her locked? Why does it seem like she's okay with this yet not? They talk about her. I mean, so many questions, and yeah, it, I'm not sure. I think they all get answered by the end. Kara, how'd you feel about the opening of this film? I mean, you know, and just everything you're just presented with quite a bit in the first 5-10 minutes, aren't you?
I wasn't really too sure what to think. I was kind of half thinking, is this a private patient, or is she a prisoner, or what's really going on? Especially because there's only one way in and out of the room, and obviously that's, she doesn't have the way out of there.
Right. Well, and then more and more of her room is revealed as we're first seeing her. I mean, her walls got all this writing on it. She gets her food from a dumbwaiter, which all the food is covered. I mean, you just, it just really, and then you think maybe she's a burn victim that he's taking care of or under his wing, because it seems like he has a kind of almost like a under the table practice of sorts out of his wonderful house. You know, you're not quite sure about the doctor. And Antonio Banderas, I think this was, for me, one of the more impressive performances we've seen from him. And, you know, Cara, what'd you think of Antonio Banderas as the Robert Lagarde character, a Lagarde character? Was it a kind of a surprise for you that he took a role like this, considering what we had seen him in before?
I was mostly familiar, I guess, just growing up in the 90s, just seeing him in those pretty boy roles like Desperado and all this other stuff. But it definitely shows that he has a lot more range. But I think it's also the fact that he's worked with Almodóvar numerous times. So they pretty much know how to work well together, and they read off each other. So it's kind of like they know what's expected when they do take on a project together. So I think that's also what really added to the mm-hmm. presentation. But I do like how it's made very known he's at least the character himself, he's very intelligent, but then throughout the course of the film you realize he's also just very cold and calculating. So it's also just this very dangerous intelligence that he has as well.
Yeah, he's a straight up mad scientist. At least the feeling I got from it. And he's a dark character for Banderas. And Andrew, how about you? Was this a surprise to see Banderas? Because as Cara said, we only seen him in kind of the pretty boy, good guy roles.
Yeah, his American roles are often, you know, where like the leading man in action movies and comedy and stuff like that. And I enjoyed those. I remember going to see Desperado and Zorro, you know, all of those. And him coming back like this, I think playing a mad scientist after having done American movies, he really could have like cheesed it up a lot more than he did. Mm-hmm. And like Cara said, this speaks to his existing relationship with, you know, having got his start in Almodóvar's movies. And so I think that's what kept it from doing that, because had this been like an American Eyes Without a Face, let's say, he would have camped it up, I think. And he probably would have had a blast doing it. You know, he could have gone full Dieter Laser if he wanted to. But instead, he keeps it exactly kind of where it needs to be, which is where kind of everyone almost in this movie is. It's where, like, you know, you only really have one innocent person.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You do really only have one innocent with this movie. And yeah, his character, well, it was interesting. I thought that was when they introduced him too, because for the first couple of minutes, you see him teaching at a school, talking about skin and people, you know, with burn victims and how you take care of them. And then you saw Vera. So you think, oh, okay. So you kind of equate the two together, and okay, she is a burn victim. But then you see he's making a deal with some guy to get blood. And you know, I mean, as that veil, that layer gets pulled back at first, we realize, okay, this is just an odd, this guy is, there's not something not right with him. And then yeah, it could have been played cheesy, but he plays it cool pretty much throughout, up until near the very end, you know, where he kind of gives in to his feelings finally. Up until that point with Vera, he always seemed to have everything pretty well figured out. But of course, there's some monkey wrenches thrown in his way, which I think we'll get to here in a minute. But one of the creepiest things for me that his character had was the camera in his the on the big screen. Up until that, even then with his lab and that, you think he's going to be kind of a straight, okay, this is kind of straight doctor, a little bit shady work, but we're talking Spain, so who knows. But then he's got this screen where he watches her. And Cara, when he's watching her the first time, do you get the impression that he's watching her because it's something like maybe perverse, or is it something that he's admiring his work?
I think after having seen the film a couple of times, I would say that to a degree there is that, not necessarily perverse, but it's that human aspect, especially because aside from the housekeeper, she's the only younger female in the house. So mm-hmm. it's I would say it's natural that he feels some sort of a an attraction or some sort of a feeling towards her, especially because he modeled her after his wife, who was a person that he obviously still very much cares for. So it makes sense that he would watch to monitor just to make sure that this person doesn't harm themselves. Plus just that whole, I want to say to a degree, just kind of like the fatherly aspect also, because Vera is somewhat of a surrogate daughter, but then later on there is that kind of like this whole Oedipal turn that does yeah. happen.
Yeah. you're right. That's the feeling, especially the second time I watched it, got more of that father feel, which Oedipal is right. It takes that turn though, then, which just, you know, it makes that even more disturbing. you know, Andrew, how about you with his big camera and watching her all the time? Is it something sexual? Is it fatherly? Is it him just admiring his work? Is it?
I think it's fascinating because, you know, on the one hand, you want to paint him as this like really organized, controlling guy, right? I mean, down to like, he's got a remote control lock on his front door. He's got, you know, I mean, he's got shit for everything. But then you also meet his brother, who is basically like a more upfront, honest, boiled down version of him. the guy in the tiger costume.
The tiger, yes.
Without question, him licking those screens to me is the yuckiest thing in the whole movie, aside from, you know, what should be the most horrible things that happen. Just in pure creep terms, he sees her, and not even in detail. He just like, well, whoever this is, I'm licking this TV and I'm finding my way in this room. So it's kind of a neat contrast, but also a neat kind of thing to compare. But a good way to show that, you know, many times over in the movie that he's in absolute control of, you know, everything, including like life and death and all of that.
At least he thinks he's in control, which sure. I mean, for the most of the film he is. I mean, and when something that does seem to get out of control or just start to, he seems to be able to plug that hole up pretty quick. I mean, you mentioned Tiger. He's gone when Tiger shows up, and that's when we get the reveal that Tiger's his brother, and the maid who's been there the whole time, who she really is, being both their mothers, which I found another interesting twist. And, you know, what happens with Vera and the Tiger and her reaction to the Tiger, I thought was interesting. And it was one of the more things that I was kind of trying to wrap my head around of her reaction. Cause one, you know, she seemed to try to run away, and then she tried to play to him to see if she could catch him off guard. Maybe I wasn't quite sure. That was just a disturbing scene, but it was also I found it interesting on how her reaction was and how she played the interaction with this very violent, grotesque, upfront individual. Kara, what'd you think? I mean, it's disturbing at all when you see violence like this, but her reaction, what did you think about that? And what do you think maybe they were going for? Was it just trying to get the tiger off balance, or was she, you know, I was a little confused on this scene, you know, compared to the way we've seen scenes like this before.
I kind of half want to say that they were kind of playing the woman angle. They're kind of like, whenever there's a woman in the house who's being threatened, just kind of like the whole, well, I'll just play along until I get the upper hand here thing. But I don't know. It's just kind of a bit odd, because you get this half sense that, do they really know each other? Do they not know each other? And we discover that she actually had no clue who he was. He just thought he knew her.
Right. Yeah. And it just throws you, because for a while they imply almost that this could be, you know, this could be his wife, this could be his daughter. They leave it a little bit as an enigma, and that scene doesn't really help too much until the end there. Andrew, what'd you think about this scene with the tiger and him breaking in and trying to, you know, well, basically he does rape her, but, you know, her reaction to the whole scenario?
I don't know. You know, it's to take it the way it is in the movie. You know, this guy is, if you want to say that he's rebuilding his wife, or just, you know, basically making someone, you know, he takes all that time to like construct the genitalia and the body and whatnot. And we know that his brother and his wife ran off together. Mm-hmm. And so here his brother is again coming in there and just, you know, not only like taking what's, well, quote unquote, his, but also damaging his work as well.
Yeah, because he's, we find out he's been growing synthetic skin, and that's what he's been kind of applying to Vera this time as well. And so this is kind of his project. Vera has become his project, and to see his brother violate him, he just offs him.
Yeah, it's just a way of seeing the way that Vera gets results, mm-hmm. and keeping kind of that whole like unpredictability that character has, to where, you know, just when you think you've got the motivations down, something else happens and it completely throws you off. So it's a great way to maintain that suspense throughout the movie in terms of character.
Yeah, and her reaction did throw me off, because, you know, from what we've normally seen, because at first she's very resistant, and then she seems to try to placate, to try to get the upper hand, saying, well, you know what, let's go in the garden, because, you know, she's trying to get out of the house, and she sees kind of an opportunity, and he goes, no, we're going into the bedroom, and she's like, oh, crap. And then, you know, afterwards, you know, I'm not sure if she seemed indifferent to the brother being shot.
Well, he's basically, I mean, if you want to say she used him to get back at the doctor, you know, right. Well done.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So she kind of goes along more with the tire because she knows it's going to disturb and piss off the doctor.
I mean, maybe. What do you think?
I'm not sure that. It might be that's why she did it. I don't know, Kara, what do you think? You think maybe that's why she didn't quite seem as resistant, and that odd scene when he comes in with the gun? Do you think she was actually kind of using this to get back at him in this weird, twisted way?
I hadn't given that any thought, but it kind of does make sense, especially when the fact that she spent so much time in the house, I'm sure to some degree she, other than the cameras that are set up, I'm sure to some degree she knew that she was being watched or monitored. It's kind of like people carry themselves differently around you when they're spying on you and acting like they don't know what's going on. It's just the whole approach is different. So I would like to at least guess to some degree that she at least had some minimal idea that she was being watched beyond the cameras, and maybe it was just kind of like her, you know, just you know, just fist and forearm at the doctor, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I did at the top of the show put this movie in the, like, basically the rape revenge category, and that's kind of where I put it when I first saw it, but I am definitely not married to that idea and would be happy to think it's more than that, but that's kind of still where I was operating when I rewatched it, and the pretense that this is a deconstruction of that kind of subgenre of a commercial film, but still there.
Yeah. And I can see that, especially within this first hour, the way this film is put together is actually quite amazing. Because this first hour or so, up until the tiger event where he shoots his brother and all that, and he gets rid of the body, then we get the creepy, weird thing of the doctor having Vera in his bed. We assume it would seem like the first time. And he tries, and I'm like, dude, she just was. Yeah. And the doctor tries to have sex with her. And is this kind of an alpha male thing of him thinking maybe he had to do this to what? For lack of a better way to put it, I do apologize to everyone, but lay claim to his, or take claim back of his project, basically, which she obviously, this is a person, but in his eyes, is this kind of the way of him doing that, Andrew? Or
I just think it's a way to show that he actually doesn't care about anyone else.
Mm-hmm. But by having her in his bedroom.
Well, by doing that, like, yeah, you said, I had the same exact thought when I was watching. I'm like, man, you should be giving her, you know, if you're gonna keep her in your house, give her a blanket. You know what I'm saying? Make her some tea, something.
Some tea. I mean, make
do,
her
do
some
not, yes.
Yeah, sandwich, tea. You know.
Yeah, this is the total wrong thing to do. And so it shows of what he actually thinks of her and how he operates as a person. It's not about saving lives or making anyone's lives better. He's operating purely for self-interest.
He is. And Kara, how about you with him having her in his bed then afterwards and that whole scene? What do you think his motivation was behind that? Would you say something like Andrew was saying, is that he just doesn't care and that she was his? Or, you know, what do you think maybe the motivation was with him on that?
I just kind of still, I'm more inclined, and I guess just more from a woman's perspective, I'm just kind of more inclined to just break it down to it just being more the primal and just giving into that, since he's been watching her for so long. And maybe to some degree it was a reminder, like, well, you do belong to me. I've been taking care of you all this time. You're my mm-hmm. property. I will do with you as I please. It is just kind of weird. It just kind of, I still kind of want to say it's some of it to some degree has to do with just the fact that she looks like his wife. So, I mean, maybe, right. Maybe on a very minute scale, there might've been some sort of concern or interest in her as the symbol of who he knew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she, her looking like his wife, I mean, the maid at one point even says, I wish you didn't choose her face. And when you realize this, he did use the, you know, face of his wife, that just, it just makes you wonder exactly just what is going on. Does he see his wife? Is it her? And then, so that's the first hour or so of this film. And then we get these sequences to where we start learning what truly happened. And that's when things really take a disturbing because, well, Kara, who do we find out Vera actually is?
The guy that raped his daughter.
Yeah. Right. It's like, wow. Which then makes that scene where he's trying to make love to her even more. Like, you're just like, what the, what is going on in this guy's mind? Because, yeah, I mean, it is the guy who raped his daughter, who caused her mental trauma, that eventually led to her killing herself. But there's also another added element with that event that happened at the wedding when she got raped. Andrew, the disturbing of his daughter, do you remember what the doctors were saying, why she won't go near her father?
Oh, yeah. And that was really great because, you know, when you're watching this in 2019, you're, you know, it is different than the kind of mind you're watching with when it came out. Because I think people now are much more in tune with the idea of someone being a survivor rather than a victim of something like rape. Because if you didn't die, you're not a victim, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I got to say, first of all, if we don't ever come back to it, Bianca Suarez, who plays his daughter, is the fucking most amazing actor in this whole movie. That's my opinion, because she has very little to do and very little screen time, but her face in every scenario, be it when she's at the party, be it when she's, you know, being about to be raped by this guy, and definitely in that hospital when he comes in, because she was knocked out when she got raped. He knocked her out and he's, you know, he left on his motorcycle. When she comes to, the first person she sees and she's still lying on her back was her dad. So when he comes to visit her in the hospital, she just screams and runs in the closet. And that is a very, very, very real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie, for, you know, there are moments maybe of dark humor, or it could be argued that it's handling some of this stuff irresponsibly. It makes me think of, and sorry to ramble about this, but the assignment that Michelle Rodriguez made a couple of years ago,
right?
Where, you know, and the idea that, a surgery like this is some sort of nightmare or punishment, it could be seen as a completely reckless decision, or even just having that as a plot device in and of itself could be seen as offensive. But with this treatment of this particular situation and this particular character and the way that she plays it, definitely in the moment and upon reflection, I feel like it has the exact kind of power it needs. And if we do want to call it a rape revenge movie, as responsibly handled as maybe you could possibly do it.
Well put. Yeah, the scenes with his daughter and her performance, those felt all too real, which I think makes this film even more disturbing, is because you're sitting there and you now that we are aware of those things. I know it was heartbreaking and disturbing for me to see her react like that, and that she was put, you know, because of the events, she was now in that state. And the fact we learned that her mom was burned and her mom ended up tossing herself off the porch in front of her. And then she has this happen. And it felt very real to me. Kara, what did you think of the daughter's reaction and how they handled her character? Do you think they handled this situation responsibly with her, or do you think it was played up at all?
I don't feel that it was overgeneralized or exaggerated, but also if you just kind of look at it from like the archetype sense of where she's just been this pampered girl, at least from the outside perspective, but then you actually get to see all this darkness that's really surrounded her. I think it makes sense that at some point in time, things like that, regardless of how well she's been carrying herself all these years, they do eventually catch up, because there's never any mention of whether she saw a therapist or had any sort of a counseling. I get the impression that maybe it was just all brushed over and she just had to keep moving forward. So there was no actual closure or anything. So it's, I don't know, I guess just kind of eventually things just got on top of her and that was just the only solution that she had available to her, at least in her mind.
Yeah, and you're right about the building up, because there's a conversation the doctor has, we find out in this flashback at a wedding, where they're asking about how she's handling it since her mom died. And you get the idea that, you know, she's on all different drugs, which it sounds like just what if she is seeing a therapist, they're just medicating her heavily. And yeah, all the events she's experienced caused her to crack. And then this thing, the horrific thing of rape, and then she kills herself, which adds further to the darkness of the doctor character, who has kidnapped the guy who did the act and has slowly and methodically changed him into a woman that looks like his wife and almost kind of resembles his daughter a little bit. Maybe it was because the wife and daughter were, you know, it just maybe because of the casting, but the face almost looked a little bit like his daughter's too, which was just odd and creepy. But finding out that Vera actually is the rapist of his daughter, and he seems to have these almost these feelings for her, was just that really messed with my mind. Kara, how about you when you finally get that reveal and you're starting to see these events unfold and how he's handling, you know, treating her, is it really hard to wrap your brain around? Like how could this be, how could he justify any of this? You know, as far as his feelings towards Vera near the end?
I don't know. I just have that tendency. I just kind of want to keep wrapping around and coming back to the whole, it's, you've got these two people similar age who have been alone in this house for years and years. It's, even if he knows biologically Vera was a man, I want to say to some degree there was still some sort of an interest, just because as a heterosexual man, Vera is now biologically a woman, even though she wasn't born that way. I want to say it's still natural to feel some sort of an interest or you know, just natural urges. I think that's inevitable, at least at some point. It's especially because we don't know exactly how many years they've both been together and how much time in isolation within each other's company they've actually spent.
Yeah, it is a little vague. They kind of drop some hints on how many years, but it could be even longer over the course of the film. And her too, she plays along, which makes you wonder, did he actually succeed in the full conversion? I mean, we find out later that no, he didn't. She was just biding her time and really trying to wait for the right moment to break free. But there is that moment for a while where you're wondering if did he win? You know, it was just, Andrew, what about you? Especially the last half hour of this film, is it a bit tough to kind of wrap your head around everything and the motivation with his character and even hers?
I don't know. You know, by the time we got into the whole thing of Vincente having been a man and all of this stuff, I started thinking about the fact that Almodovar is gay, mm-hmm. and my mind just started, you know what I'm saying?
Wow, like doing
cartwheels,
sure.
You know, because I was like, what does that mean? Does it mean anything? You know, and I started to think about how female centric is most of his work is, and how like generational a lot of the stories are. And I just wasn't quite, I don't think I was there. That's why I was looking forward to talking about this, because, you know, at that point, my mind was just doing cartwheels, you know.
I know my mind was doing cartwheels with it, you know, trying to understand. And I agree with Kara's talk of, you know, how they've been together so long and he's worked so closely with her that eventually, I guess he might forget that this was a man at a certain point in time, or he has embraced the fact, but he's felt maybe that he's made this person better.
Or if it's not even about necessarily any other person but him, why would it matter?
Oh, so you're thinking maybe that it's centered around him. He feels he won, especially after she started to show affection towards him, or at least not find him repulsive, and actually appeared to want to be with him, that he thought maybe he won, and that just played to his own selfishness.
Well, it's a good way to set up that ending where he's totally got by her, you know, and a good way to kind of forward the idea that maybe she was just biding her time and waiting for this and mm-hmm. making, not giving him any reason to think she's not going to grab the closest weapon and kill the shit out of him, you know?
Yeah, that was the part. I mean, that was the part. He sends her on a shopping spree, which again, his way of thinking, I'm like, that's what, here, she has the card, go buy what you want. I'm like, how chauvinistic can that really be? I mean, just, oh yeah, he can buy her. You feel like almost. And then he gets called out by his coworker saying, yeah, I know that Vera is actually a guy, and she covers for the doctor, but they're in bed that night. And she's like, oh, I left whatever down in my purse. And he just like, oh yeah, okay. And I'm just sitting here going, ego is such the major, you know, Achilles heel to all these main crazy doctors. And she does exact her revenge pretty quick on everybody. Kara, do you think this ending, as far as, because here we have the person who was a rapist, who's had all these things done to them because of that act, and now she is exacting her revenge, yet at the end you almost feel sorry for this person, at least the way the film makes it sound. Would you say that they're leaning towards that even though this person did this horrific thing, by the end they actually have you feeling for the rapist in some way? Or
I want to say to some degree they did kind of pull those strings a bit, but then you also have to consider the fact that this is a person who was taken and had their physical appearance changed against their will. Something like that is definitely very disturbing. It's something that could have broken him, but as far as coping mechanism, they have all of the writing on the walls, they use yoga. Mm-hmm. So they definitely made an effort to at least persevere, because I want to say at least to some degree they knew eventually they'd get out of this. Otherwise, mm-hmm. there would have just been that desperation and mental collapse. So I want to say that there's definitely a lot more strength there than that. You kind of have to really look between the lines in order to see it, especially if you're looking at it from the aspect of they kept their mind together all this time. And then once they saw the opportunity, they actually played that card to get the upper hand on the doctor and eventually did get out of there. But I kind of want to say you kind of get kind of like this little half prize at the end, because he gets out of there and makes his way back to the dress shop, talks to the girl he always liked to, which now, if something were to work out, that relationship were possible because he's a woman.
Yeah, and she was a lesbian, which is an interesting ending for the film, and it almost is implied, but I just thought it was strange that the film would set up a character like this to, at the end, you do kind of get to where, okay, well, this person who's a rapist has had this, but at the same time, hey, the rapist got away from the very crazy mad scientist. Andrew, what do you think? Does this leave an audience a bit conflicted with exactly how they're supposed to feel at the end? Is there some payoff?
Well, he's fucking with the way that, like the archaic eye for an eye stuff that mm-hmm. we tend to want to see in movies. And because, you know, the rapist in the movies, like something like I Spit on Your Grave, classic example, is then the one that is then murdered, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because the person died that this person raped, the dad could have easily run him off the road and, you know, shot him, and that would have been it. But instead he chose to work out all this other stuff, which, you know, then he could have just been like, all right, well, I'm going to show you what violation is. I'm going to show you what losing your humanity is. I'm going to show you what being a piece of fucking meat is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you what cruelty is. You're not going to get off easy. You know, we'd skipped over the part where he'd had this guy chained up in a, you know, windowless, airless basement, starving him to death, giving him no water, no food, and he hadn't seen anyone. So, you know, you think about it, like in movies, the way we punish people, and in life, the way that we punish people, and the way people are just canceled these days, you know? And, you know, on the one hand, you're like, yes, good. Fuck you.
Yeah.
You don't deserve anything. Look what you did. You took someone's humanity away. But it does make us think about like our ideas and feelings about that, and our like kind of biblical need to see revenge happen like swiftly.
Mm-hmm. It totally turns it on its head. And I remember when this film first ended, I was like, I'm not sure how I'm supposed to feel about this.
Was he rehabilitated? Do you feel?
I think so, actually. I mean, I think he was rehabilitated. It's an extreme way to go about it, but I think he got perspective. That's for sure. On what he did, he did not get away easy for the crime he did, and I think he did get rehabilitated. And I don't think at this point, and I think that'd be a good question here, is I don't think he ever pursues to try to become a man again after this, personally, because of what he went through. But I'd be interested in your guys' opinion on that. Say after, you know, all these events, and he finally catches back up to his mom and her coworker, and they have that moment just before the credits roll. Kara, do you think that Vincente tries to go back to being a man, or does he accept what has happened to him because of his punishment and stays a woman?
My assumption is that they did remain a woman, but not necessarily because they've accepted some sort of a punishment that was forced mm-hmm. on them. I kind of still want to go back to the fact that while they were being held captive the entire time they were there, he was working on right. self-acceptance, which to me just kind of references back to the title, The Skin I Live In, like becoming comfortable with who you now are and self-acceptance mm-hmm. and just moving forward from there. I mean, very quite literally the skin that was put on him, but also just the metaphor of being comfortable in your own skin as a person. I think at least that's the way I kind of want to read mm-hmm. into it, and in reference to the title and how maybe he may have moved on, or how he was able to actually exist and just mentally survive all of that.
Do you think maybe he was more comfortable then in the skin he was in, or that he grew to be comfortable, or was this something deep inside him maybe?
Mm-hmm. I'm just more he grew to be comfortable, just kind of mm-hmm. he learned to accept this new body, this new face, So it's just more self-acceptance in that sense, rather than just letting it tear him apart. Like, well, I'm no longer a man. I no longer have this penis, which defines my sex. I'm a woman. But he doesn't look at it as, oh, I'm just this weakling either. It's not in the sense of he hasn't been downgraded the way the doctor intended, but I think he just finds just more that strength in this whole thing, just to, you know, the inner strength rather than, so I don't want to play it off as it's a metaphor for one sex being superior to the other or any of that either. It's just, I just always read it as he just learned to be comfortable with who he became and he accepted that.
Cool. Andrew, what about you? You think, he goes back to being a guy, or is he grown comfortable with the skin he lives in?
Jesus, I can't follow that answer. Cara, that was brilliant.
I know, it was, wasn't it? That was like, wow, this is really good for this.
On top of the many brilliant things you have said during this conversation, that was just like, well, I'm just logging off. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this spoiler. Appreciate
Yeah, I know. She gave that answer, and I'm just like, that's way too good for this show. Holy crap.
Man, I don't know if your mic is on a stand, but that was a drop right there.
It was mic drop, definitely.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really have to kind of just like I said, how I've kind of framed the movie for me. You know, when that something like that has happened to someone, and I'm not talking about what's happened to Vincente necessarily, I'm talking about what has happened to Norma. It's, you know, you're like, well, no punishment could possibly match it, you know. And then often, like I say in these movies, it is the sentence is death. But why is that any good? You know, my big problem with I Spit on Your Grave was always just like how she kind of used sexuality or whatever to get back on these guys. And I'm like, you know, just smoke them. But what a, you know, what an archaic idea. Like, well, if he has done irreparable harm to someone, meaning that, you know, he is indirectly responsible for someone's death, but definitely responsible for taking their humanity. For him to also die might be kind of like whatever, poetic or considered like, you know, like eye for an eye, but that's really not what should happen. If we really think about it, he should also experience some irreparable loss and some part of himself that he can never gain back and never feel like an entire person again, to mirror that kind of, you know, the damage of trauma and really always have a reminder of what he'd done. And, you know, in a lot of the movies, the big deal is like, well, we're just going to cut the dick off. You know,
yeah,
it's like, well, you will never use this again to hurt anybody. I'm like, well, that's what you get. You cut dick is cut off. Mm-hmm. But what his life ends up having to be, I think if you're gonna be given a some sort of a satisfying conclusion, this is probably the only way that it could happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do get some. Not satisfaction, but some a payoff a bit for everything to happen, because you just realize that now Vincente, now Vera, will have to probably live like this. And every time, even though he's become comfortable in his skin, there's going to be part of that person that looks in the mirror and is reminded of everything that happened, not only to them in the room, but also for what they did that led them to this, I think. And yeah, death in some of those, in most of these movies always seems a little too quick. And this is something that is a punishment that will live with this person forever.
Yeah. You know, but is it a punishment to be a woman? You know, that's definitely a question that it raises too, I feel. Because there's a scene, I think, earlier in the movie about a dress, and there's a callback to that as well. Mm-hmm. But I can't remember like verbatim what it is, but I want to say that might have kind of been the key.
Oh, that. Yeah, there's a scene, because in the flashback we get Vincente talking to the one female employee of his mom's, and he's hitting on her and being, you know, just that type of guy, and they talk about a dress. You know, he says, this is a great looking dress. And she goes, well, if it's so great looking, why don't you wear it? And he says something along the fact of, well, I would, but it would look better on you.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then he's wearing, they are wearing that dress at the end of the movie. And that is how they are able to get across that, hey, it's Vicente. And yeah, it's an interesting exploration. And I'm not sure though, if it was saying that, maybe I'm blind to it, that, you know, being the woman was a punishment. It is a punishment so much for, say, in general, but for that specific character, right? You know, I don't think it's trying to make a generalization of saying, oh, well, women, you know, becoming a woman is a punishment so much as this person who was like this. We saw him, you know, always hitting on, even though he knows she's a lesbian, he's hitting on her and being, you know, stereotypical guy type things. It's a punishment for him. I don't think they're trying to make a statement about a general statement, but that's just the way I took it, was that this particular character, this would be their ultimate kind of, you know,
we can't forget that he is guilty of something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Through the whole time, you can't forget that. And that's why I always found it weird that, and it goes along with what Kara has been saying during the show, is that people living together long enough, something's, you know, it just naturally is started occurring. It just surprised me, considering the doctor, what this person did, you know, it seemed like the doctor almost forgot that at some point. He got lost in his own project, basically. And almost forgot his original motivation for doing things. I think it became more for him than just the revenge after a while, because he was so good at it, for lack of a better term. But yeah, the film, when the credits roll, there's so many things that hit your head, and then you watch it again, and those questions, I think, are still kind of there. And speaking of questions, I was wondering, Andrew, did you have something we didn't cover? Maybe you wanted to talk about some more, or had some questions on that we can discuss and maybe flesh out?
I don't know. Are we running long? Flesh out. That's good.
Thank you. No, we're not running. We're still doing good. So,
Well, I don't know. We can do an Almodovar related question, or I can nerd a little bit about some trivia. What do you want to hear?
let's nerd on some trivia.
All right, so the woman who plays the servant, his helper, I cannot remember the character name.
Marilla. Marilla. I forgot.
I don't know. The movie is full of support players that have been in his other movies. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to know that his movie after this was like his silliest, like straight up goofy comedy, you know what I mean, that he mm-hmm. ever done. See, I'm doing it. Damn it.
Go ahead.
Volver was kind of veered toward the supernatural. There's like, was a ghost in it, the movie, I think, before this. All right. But that actor, I noticed on Wikipedia, it's got her selected filmography. What they left off of it is one of the most disturbing movies I've ever seen. It is called In a Glass Cage, Trazel Cristal. Have either of you heard of In a Glass Cage?
I have not. Kara, have you?
I never heard of it.
And your listeners will be interested in this movie. And it is something that, interestingly, has some parallels with this. It is about a guy who is, as a boy, is molested by a Nazi. And I can't remember if he was raped or what, but it was like, you know, completely violated by a Nazi. Years down the road, grows up. And he ends up as the caregiver of a guy in an iron lung, an old man, and he finds out that that was the guy.
Oh,
and
and
it's a revenge movie too, but whoo, 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 whoo. But she's in that.
Oh, cool.
Right? So I don't know if that even went anywhere, but there you go.
No, there you go. You're a fan of the director then, Andrew?
Of Almodovar? Yeah. Or I think. Yeah, I think the guy that made In a Glass Cage, I I want to see, maybe it's Villaronga or something. I can't name you another movie that he did. Yeah, I love Almodovar, man. I mean, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, I've dedicated myself to telling stories about women and having them tell their own stories and all of that. And so I've been a fan of his since junior high. Our Spanish teacher showed us A Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And what a thing to show to kids, pretty much. But we were like, you know, ninth grade or something like that. But still, fantastic. I love his movies. I haven't seen the new one, but I did review Julieta, and I thought it was brilliant. I love how he never completely went back to 100% reality, I feel, after this. He was on this sort of, you know, he started to kind of veer into, you know, movies that leave themselves open a bit more to interpretation. Things weren't quite as spelled out for you, a little bit more mysterious. And so, yeah, he's just, I've loved kind of what he's grown into. I liked seeing him do horror, and he's definitely decided to do a horror movie. But even still, I feel it's a trip watching, as a fan, watching how some of his trademarks still kind of creep their way into it.
Cool. Yeah, I was not too familiar with the director outside of this film and Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down. So I had seen the titles. I haven't actually watched most of the films, but I may start to after revisiting this, because definitely a lot of interesting things going on in this film. And he seems,
as a movie nerd, you would love it, because he's a total movie nerd too.
Oh, is he?
Oh God, yeah. Well, this, and you know I mentioned it a couple times before, but it is not a remake of Eyes Without a Face, but it is so like in the parking space next to it.
Sure.
And now that you've seen this, going back and watching that, that's actually what I did before the show. I was watching Eyes Without a Face, and there's the jump out the window. There's the, you know, there's the mask. There's the wife burning in the car. There's like all of that's there.
I might have to visit that film as well. So definitely put that on the list. Kara, how about you? Is there something that maybe you wanted to talk about, discuss, or you know, that we haven't covered yet tonight with this film?
I mostly just kind of a half thought that just occurred to me while y'all were discussing earlier, but it kind of makes me go back and question, why on earth would he put his wife's face on his daughter's rapist? Like putting the face of someone you love on someone you absolutely hate. And then there's kind of like this whole correlation of, without, you know, love and hate cannot exist separately, which is kind of weird in itself. I don't know. Maybe I'm just overthinking that, or just a little loose bit of lint that I pulled on and realized I'm tearing the sweater up.
No, I like that. The love and hate can't live without each other. Andrew, what do you think? You think maybe you've got some of that going on?
I think, once again, an amazing observation. Holy shit. All right. So let's say that he just hates his wife for what she did. Mm-hmm. And he is not getting revenge for his daughter, but he is getting his own revenge for what his wife did to him.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Making the rapist his wife is a statement about how he felt about his wife.
I mean, I don't even know if it's a statement. I think it's just like him.
Or just him
being
kind of like two birds with one stone or something.
Yeah. Or being just an even bigger self-centered asshole, egotistical, narcissistic piece of shit. You know what I mean?
Which he is.
Right. Exactly. Thank you. As much as he is. Because we didn't actually completely say he was a piece of shit, but we probably should make sure we do that. For that, operating on the assumption that he does not actually care enough to even get revenge for his daughter, then that would kind of, I guess, like that would all work out. No,
it really fits. If he was, then his sole motivation wasn't even with dealing with his daughter; it was him getting his revenge on his wife. That's wow. Kara, you've got way too cool of insights for this show, I think.
Great.
It's great. Oh, wow, because I hadn't thought of that till then you brought it up, and that could fit a lot of things in this film, because he is a piece of shit. I mean, there's no qualms about it. This guy is an asshole. The doctor is throughout. He doesn't really change. There is no change in his character, except maybe giving in a little bit to his feelings with Vera, but even that's self-centered still. So yeah, that really puts this movie in another perspective and makes sense in a lot of ways. Maybe it's always hard to tell. I love movies where it's kind of hard to tell what the director exactly was going for. Kara, you definitely bring up a number of great points that definitely would fit this film, and could be what he was going for. I'm not sure if it is, but that really does fit the love, hate, and getting his revenge and with his wife. And yeah, that now it just makes me almost want to watch it again. But I may need some time on that.
I mean, I think that's what makes it such a great film, is that they give you enough little puzzle pieces to where you actually want to continue chasing the breadcrumbs. So they don't actually feed you the story. They kind of give you enough to where maybe you put in some filler and you kind of make your own little story out of it. And it gives you more to continue to think about. But each time you go back and rewatch it, you see and you notice something different. So it's never the same story every single time you watch it.
Yeah, and it's great when you get a film like that, because the rewatching it makes it almost like a new film. when you approach it again and see other things, you're right about it. Watching it this time, second time around, while I knew the main core, I saw different things, and suddenly I took things differently than I did the first time, which there's a lot to take in with this film. When the credits roll and you've watched the whole thing, there's a lot in this film. This is a pretty dense film as far as subjects and things going on. Cause like, yeah, you're absolutely right, Carl. The breadcrumbs they give you, you don't get really definite explanations on everything, which is my favorite type of movie. Personally, I don't like when my hand is held too long for most films. And yeah, it's definitely one of those films. So final question of the night, and we'll wrap it up here so we don't go too long. And it's a question that has popped up on the internet all the time. So we'll start with you, Kara. Is this a horror movie or a thriller?
I kind of want to just break away and just refer to it in musical terms. It's more of a fusion, because you've kind of got, to a degree, some dark psychology going. You do have the thriller aspects, but then you've also, it's kind of like mad scientist and biohorror. It's not just one specific theme. You can also just, to some degree, call it a drama.
Yeah. Yeah. It could very well be a drama, especially a Spanish drama, because I've seen some of those and those get pretty wild. But yeah, Andrew, how about you? Horror film, thriller? Is it a fusion?
I probably already called it a horror movie like a few times.
So you did. That's true.
I don't know if I've changed my mind about that. You know, but I know that Almodovar considers it a horror because he deliberately wanted to play in that genre, you know. But to me, there's because it has so much in common with a horror classic, and also you know, follows a lot of those suspense beats as far as going non-linear and all of that. I just feel I remember back to the audience when I went to see it were fucking horrified.
So horror, there you go.
And I don't mean like, you know, dudes crossing their leg, you know what I mean? I mean like, I just want to leave type of shit. And I've been to stuff I don't know if, did you see Good Night Mommy? Do you remember that one?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember just a row of women there, probably, you know, students. And they were getting visibly uncomfortable with just the creepiness. You know what I'm saying? It's like, when's something just going to make a loud noise and scare me? What's this going on here? At one of them, at one point, just taps her friend on the shoulder. I'm out of here. She just laughed. You know, and it makes you feel great, because you love to see an artist's work actually work. Mm-hmm. And so I do feel as though he was meaning to be scary.
Yeah, and I think he accomplishes that without any jump scares or anything along that lines. It's still a scary movie, and I consider it a horror film, body horror especially. You know, and I think Roger Ebert even described it as such, in his review, or mentioned it, that it was a horror film without any scares or, you know, in your face type of moments, but still overall it's a pretty dang scary movie.
I think it's what makes it lean into more that horror realm, is you have all these dark elements, but it's more, maybe not necessarily a character study, but no one in the film is perfect, but you're definitely studying the human condition as the monster. Like, we all have these dark elements and these parts of ourselves that we hide or try to hide and we fail at, but we all have this dark aspect to us, and the film just totally hands itself over to it. It doesn't shy away from it, and it doesn't try to buff anything over or pussyfoot it. It's just, it tells it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we want to give it more than just horror, especially too, because of the filmmaker. Almodovar cannot not have sex as an element, cannot have drama as an element, cannot have some humor, and cannot, like, you know, just turn his back on his ability to tell a giant story, way more than just what's on the surface. But also, you know, there's the talk of the father, there's the talk of the father's father, there's then the family being an element here. There's so much more to it. So to kind of just want to boil it down to a genre, yeah, is definitely feels unfair. I'll give it that.
Yeah. And I agree, it can't just fit into one genre, because all of the elements that you guys both said, Kara and Andrew, I want to thank you tonight, because you voice ideas in far better language than I can. So I think we'll wrap it up here tonight with this. I appreciate your time. And now, as always with these episodes, it is a license to shill. Kara, why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners where they can find your work at?
I'm actually finally back on YouTube. So I'm back to putting out horror reviews semi-regularly. So you can find me over at Horror Retrospective, or if you just kind of want to keep up with maybe some of the little random things that I do. I'm also over on Twitter at @retro_horrors.
Fantastic. And Andrew, go ahead, sir.
Oh, I just wanted to say it was a pleasure, man. Kara, I'm so glad that we did it. And Mark, you're a very insightful dude. Don't sell yourself short. You're a great host. Thank you. You know, we wouldn't say these things if you had not prompted us or given us a reason to, you know.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was a total pleasure. And I finally I feel like I understand the movie now because of this. I feel like I've got my answers. So, you know, well done. Well, very well done. Promote myself. Let's see. Currently, you can see some of my films on Amazon Prime and some of the Gonzorific crew here in Athens, Georgia, a group of incredible women who make incredible films and who are definitely a constant source of inspiration and making me a better person and a better artist, and furthering my understanding of my favorite thing, which is movies. Coquette Dujour's film, The Glittering, starring Rebel Bell, is there. Sugar Skull, starring Chopper Bleed and Theo Rose, Barry Scary, starring the incomparable Mia Mayo, and May of the Dead, starring Zombarella and Joy Wood. All of those you can find on there. Please say something nice. If you don't have something nice to say, fuck you. Go somewhere else. I made these movies with my friends, and they are not, if they're not for you, then they're not for you. But I want to have them where people can see them. Otherwise, yeah, all the other places, Instagram, you can get exclusive photos and stuff like that, behind the scenes things on Facebook and on Twitter and YouTube. There's commercials with me and them trying to get people to buy my DVDs, so you could, you know, enjoy that. But Gonzarella's in them too. I think she puts our Blu-ray in her cleavage and it stays. So that was neat. Thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. And thank you both for doing this. I always appreciate my panel and my guests and my crew members for joining us tonight. So I hope this, maybe you found some answers as well into this very interesting film. And now I think we'll just say good night, everyone.
Buenas noches, right?
Buenas noches. That's
Buenas nachos. No, I'm not, now I'm getting hungry.
Love nachos. Hey, all my friends out there looking for more Spoiler Room goodness, then why don't you check out our brand new Patreon page, patreon.com/specialmarkproductions, where you can get access to exclusive Spoiler Room episodes and a whole lot more. You can also find us on Facebook groups at SMPRD and on to Twitter at Special Mark Pro. Let your voice be heard and let us know what you would like to see in the Spoiler Room, as well as just how we're doing in general. We appreciate your support, and remember, in the Spoiler Room, the conversation is fresh, but we do spoil the movies.